coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello, everybody. Happy Tuesday night. I hope you are all doing well. We've had good news out of the Middle East. At least there's a ceasefire right now. Speaking of the Middle East, here in a couple weeks, we will be having some fully pre-recorded episodes coming up. As always, whenever I'm out on the road for clients, we always have new content for you. And we will be featuring some great stuff. We'll have Keith Seeland, Kim DeRosiers will be in there, Joshua Shapiro. Archbishop James Cloud will be coming on to talk about literally the Middle East and end times prophecy, things like that. So stay tuned for that one. We'll have Jason Quitt, Stephen Myers tonight, folks. In the second part of the episode, we are pleased to have on for the first time head of New Mexico MUFON, Maria Tellier. We will be talking about the Holloman Air Force Base UFO landing and some of the information that she, as the head of MUFON New Mexico, has dug up on the case. It's pretty fascinating, affidavit and all. In the first segment, I am very, very proud to welcome for the first time Mr. Daniel Brinkley. He is a near-death experiencer. He is an author. He is the founder of not only the Twilight Brigade, which we will get into, which is a fantastic, fantastic mission, but also the Brinkley Center for exploring life after death. Welcome to the show, Daniel Brinkley. How are you this evening?
I'm quite wonderful, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on this evening. Truly, it is an honor to have you on the show. You are.
Well, let's thank Michelle. Let's thank Michelle also.
Absolutely. Thank you as always, Michelle. I can't thank Michelle enough. Honestly, she does really, really hard work for us. She does an amazing, so much so that she's thanked in our credits of the show.
Yeah, but
every week.
But Christopher, when you see somebody, when she sees something that she sees possibility in, seeing all the stuff that she sees,
yeah,
and she looking to help build your audience, I'm going to be supportive of her looking for talent and creative podcast. I'm going to be looking for that and help probably create or expand your brand. So I'm thankful for her for finding you for me. So thank you.
Well, absolutely. And same here, Daniel. It's the fact of I have come over the years to trust Michelle implicitly. Sometimes she will just send me a guest name and be like, I know you may not have heard of him. I'm like, I trust you. Fully, like, you have never brought me a bad guest. There's never been a conversation that I have not enjoyed from somebody that she works with, because she really does look for amazing people with amazing stories. So
yeah, but she looks for amazing interviewers.
Oh, well,
okay.
Thank you.
Everybody thank has people telling a story, Christopher. Everybody has those.
That's
there's,
true.
But the ability to see someone who does good interviews, that cares about current topics and subjects, and looks at it from different slants, so that people have an option of what they think they see is real and what's really real. So I'm complimenting her on finding you.
Well, thank you. Truly, one of the big missions of my show, Daniel, because yeah, you're right. There are a lot of people out there telling stories. There are a lot of people out there sharing experiences, things like that. But my show is truly there to help demystify these topics for people who may not be onboarded onto those topics, may not be interested in those topics at all. You know, but it can still reach them. Given the opportunity, given the right angle.
Everybody's interested in my topic. My topic never goes out of style, Chris.
I will fully concur with that, because, you know, when you get into the concept of life after death to begin with, Daniel, I'm a former Catholic seminarian, former youth minister, all kinds of things. So The world hereafter, I was greatly, greatly invested in for a very, very good amount of my life. I think still greatly invested in the way I live my life. But it was a religious experience that brought me to the seminary and changed my life and changed the way I looked at things. And sure, that can be very hard to share. And your experience especially is one that I think is a touchstone for a lot of people out there, you know, to the point that they're when you had your experience in 1975, it's not like there was IANS.
It didn't have a name.
Yeah.
When I had the experience, exactly, it didn't have a name.
Yeah.
Raymond Moody had not coined the term near-death experience. That didn't. He published the book in 75, but it didn't come into the world until 76. So I had this experience with absolutely nothing.
Wow.
No way to grip it, no place to understand it, no religious perspective, nothing.
Yeah.
And I go from one day I always say I never believed any of this stuff. The next day I was dead. The day after that I became everything I never believed. Okay. And so I have looked at the fact that we're spiritual beings for now 50 years. I spent 20 years with Raymond. And I drove Raymond and the near-death experience into mainstream reality. I mean, I'll say there's a lot of other people, but they say I've sold over 20 million books. And they say the average person, if one person buys a book, that means two other people have read it, so three people. So that would be 90 million people have read those books in 25 countries and 21 languages. So they tell me. So I'd have to say that I made an impact in the fact that with Paul Perry. I think somebody you should have on your show is Paul Perry.
Okay.
Because Paul Perry is he's the perfect observer of the near-death experience.
And interesting.
He's the best observer of it, because he's never had one, but he's written 10 books on it and 5 New York Times bestsellers.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And people need, it's like you say, Chris, people need to understand the world is going crazy because it's in a new cycle. A brand new era is being born. If you look at what the Maya said, all things not done integrity would collapse. Everything is collapsing.
Yep.
And what they said in 2,600 years ago was the next era, this era now, that we started December 21st, 2012, there would be no secrets. And look at where intelligence is. Look at where all that stuff is. So
yeah,
when you look at the fact that the near-death experience is created by cardiopulmonary resuscitation techniques, it is everybody who tells us there's nothing next. who bring us back to prove that they're wrong. When you look at the near-death experience and it's 50 years old, that it's a golden anniversary, then what is tonight? Let's start for a minute. Talk for a moment. What is the cultural legacy of the near-death experience? Number one, you are not going to freaking die.
Yeah.
Number two, 95% of everybody who ever has a near-death experience sees themselves floating above their body. You look at it in the car wreck, lying in the bed, on the street, but they're looking at their body. The thing that no one ever asks, if you're looking down at your body, then who is the observer?
Yeah.
That's the real you. And number three, you're an electrical being. The very moment you package that as a part of your reality, your whole concept of how you see yourself and the world you live in changes, and you don't have to be dead. You are not. You either a solid, liquid, or a gas in the physical form. A solid, liquid, or a gas. Until 1904, on the periodic table, there was an element called ether.
Yep.
Ether was too close to understanding your energetic nature, your energetic reality. So they took it off the periodic table, and until quantum came in the 2000s, and they have another name, plasma. So now you have 4 states of matter, physical, mental, solid, liquid, gas, plasma, solid, liquid, gas, ether. Once you understand that ether being is the being that's the real you, as opposed to physically being you. Your life changes. I'm from South Carolina. Growing up in the 50s in South Carolina, everybody goes to hell down here.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's going to hell in South Carolina. And I've been told I was going to hell since I was like 5 years old, so I didn't have any problems about whether I was going to hell or not. It just, it never happened.
Yeah.
It's never happened. So all that crap that people are told their whole life to believe in, and all the threats that are made about going home to God, all that stuff is basically nonsense. And when you were talking about the Middle East, I believe that the overlords, the rulers, are taking what is the Book of Revelations and recreating it in the Middle East tonight.
Yeah. Yeah. At least attempting to by their own template, you know.
Exactly. That's what it looks like to me, especially when you look at the greater Israel concept, that in order to rebuild the temple, you have to have the same landmass as Solomon had.
Yeah.
Which is a third of Egypt, all of Gaza, Palestine, Samaria, Judea,
yeah,
all of Jordan, half of Lebanon, and 2/3 of Syria, and all of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, when you start looking at things like. The fact that they've already purchased the red heifers, they purchased those from Texas, right here in Austin. They purchased them from a ranch just outside of town. It's interesting to see all those things lining up, Danyon. And for you, especially as somebody who, let's start, this loops us, just so you know, folks, directly into his experience, because with your experience in 1975 and your experiences after, came visions, came messages, Danyon. So for those in the audience who may not be familiar with your first experience in 1975 and the entities and messages that you received, let's get into that real quick.
Well, in 1975,
yes, please.
I was sitting on the edge of a bed in 1975, talking on the telephone. Lightning came down the phone line. It was a landline. So lightning came down the phone line, hit me in the side of the head, went down my spine. It welded the nails of the heels of the shoes to my feet. The nails of the heels of the shoes to the floor and threw me in the air. I'm paralyzed and slams me back down. I'm paralyzed. I'm burning. I'm on fire, and I could not see.
Wow.
And I didn't know what had happened. I didn't know about the lightning. I just didn't register it. And then all of a sudden, I lift out of my body. No pain. I could see. I was safe. I was comfortable. And I'm watching them work on my body. I'm watching the ambulance come. I went next door and called the ambulance. The guy came over who was on the other end of the phone. And here I was watching all this. They put me on the ambulance, and I'm in the ambulance, and the guy said, "He's gone. He's gone." And I'm watching it, and I thought, "Gone where?" I hadn't registered the fact that I was floating above my body, that I was going to the hospital. That had not registered with me. I was still feeling the place that I was and the safety and the comfort that I had. Then all of a sudden, when he said he's gone, I could sense this tunnel forming over my left shoulder, and I could sense it. And then I looked, and then all of a sudden I start moving down this tunnel. Now, coming to this place of light, I mean, beautiful golden, silvery light. No, it was bluish, silvery light. And this being comes close to me as though to make me feel comfortable. But wherever I was better than where I left.
Mm.
That was the point. Wherever I was better. And then I had what was called the panoramic life review, which is the single most important thing anybody listening tonight should get. You will see your entire life pass before you in a 360-degree panorama. You will watch it from a second person point of view as though you were your own best friend. And then you will literally become every person that you ever encounter, and you will feel the direct results of your interaction between you and that person. Nobody gets away with anything. And it's never about what you do. It's about why you do it. And somewhere in that conversation, you will ask yourself this one question. If the divine, or if God, couldn't come today and God sent you in the life you just reviewed, what difference did you and God make? I became a hospice volunteer because knowing what I knew about being dead, when I could walk, what I could do about being dead, and what I knew about veterans, because I'm an old Marine, and what I knew about veterans, that I could make a difference in the life. So I created the Twilight Brigade, which became one of the largest end-of-life care volunteer programs for dying veterans in American history. And then I co-wrote the standard end-of-life care model for the Veterans Administration. And now I'm working on the Brinkley Foundation, which is about using energetics. We have to look at the ethereal spiritual nature of beings. And we have to look at it. And I look at traumatic brain injury. That is more than a chemical problem. It's an energetic frequency harmonic problem. And so thanks for putting me on, Chris, because
absolutely,
anyone can look at this and see where I'm going and what I'm doing, contribute, support, keep up to date, ask questions, and do all that. Because if I can affect traumatic brain injury, then I'm going to reduce the amount of suicide rates among the veterans that are passing today. And we only have like 18,000 veterans left. I mean, mostly Vietnam, but there's about 28 killing themselves every day.
Yeah.
And that, if I can reduce that number by one or two, then I think I'm being successful. And I think I have a pathway and a program that will achieve it.
Well, and it truly is a beautiful mission, Daniel, because, you know, once again, the statistic staggeringly and horrifyingly is, yes, approximately one an hour, approximately one veteran an hour takes their own life. And that is that
average age 51.
That's horrible. That is one of the most horrible statistics that we have. And, you know, Much like we've talked about with UFOPD, the idea of first responders not being able to tell their stories. I'm sure that there are numerous veterans out there, especially that were field wounded, things like that, Daniel, that had experiences similar to yours.
I've heard, sure. But think of this, Chris. I've had veterans who've seen extraterrestrial craft.
Yeah.
I haven't, you know, when you've been through, I've been with 2,017 people going from this world to the next.
Wow.
358 taking their last breath. I've been a hospice volunteer for 48 years. And I've been through since the Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, all the major conflicts, I've been through them. I'm, you know, with veterans. And so the stories that I know to be true from people who had nobody to tell it to but me.
Yeah.
Because I would come to see them. And some of these guys I would know 5 and 6 years because they would be in the CLCs, the continuous living centers. And I would go and they would tell me their stories. I would always ask them, you know, where'd you serve? What happened? And I've heard some of the greatest, most remarkable stories in the world.
And, you know, once again, those experiences, when they happen to you, can be a burden. They can be entirely burdensome. It can be hard to much no different than the PTSD and being able to share that with family.
You can't tell people. There's no language. And when I started, I mean, people were condemning me. You should have heard it. And everybody was so scared to death of death that anything that changed the narrative. Here I am. I am dead. 28 minutes dead. Put into the room. Going to take me to the morgue. And when they put me in the hospital, patient unconscious, patient not breathing, no EKG. if you're unconscious and you're not breathing and you have no EKG for 28 minutes, what does that tell you that you are? What's it tell you?
Not there in all theory.
And in the course of that, I had this experience, and then I went to these crystal cities, this thing that, I mean, I describe it as that because if you're driving into Denver at night, and you see all the houses up on the mountainside, and it's just so beautiful. They're like these crystal cities, and I met these 12 beings, and then this 13th being, and they were showing me, if you keep doing the same thing you're always going to do, this is the probable possibilities of your future. When I went to write Saved by the Light, because I was really angry, and I decided that people were pushing and hurting people who were telling their stories about having near-death experiences, and they're being so ridiculed, and Raymond, Dr. Moody, had been so beaten back by all the things that he was facing and dealing with. The philosophers turned on him, the MDs turned on him, the psychiatrist turned on him, so I got mad and decided to write a book. And I wrote Saved by the Light. And in Saved by the Light, in chapter 5, I wrote what those beings of light told me. Paul and I sat down and we categorized them. And the publisher did not want to publish the book because one of the events, which is like 16 years later, was happening right at the time frame I said it had to do with Iranians and submarines. And they didn't want to put it. And I said, look, I'm not going to publish the book. You can have your money back. I don't really care. I did this because Raymond asked me to do it. And in the shape he is, sure, I'll do it. And I figured it was time for somebody to push somebody to their own size. And I figured it was time to start pushing me around because I'd had this experience. And so when we wrote him, I said, well, let me tell you something. If this stuff happens, that means there's a life after death. Because I got this stuff when I was quote unquote dead. If I'm wrong, then I was hallucinating and I owe all the people who bought this book an apology. But are you going to put them in there?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're now 50. We're now 30, 33 years later. And stuff I wrote down in a notebook in 1977 that became Saved by the Light, published in 1994.
Yeah.
Well, 95% of all those so-called visions have come true.
Remarkable.
So many before and since then, all the things, like today. Today is box 4 and box 13. Box 4 describes the war in the Middle East. And box 13 is the final vision, which is what the Brinkley Center is and will be when it's done.
Well, and before we get into the Brinkley Center and this vision, let's take one step back real quick to the entities, Danyon. When you met these entities, when you were first presented to them, What was your overall impression? What did you feel in that moment? Do you remember?
I wasn't dead and I wasn't in hell. So any place I was other than those two places as a point of reference was okay with me. I wasn't having a religious experience.
Sure.
I was understanding how reality formatted itself and how it operated and how it worked. And that's what I was learning. And these beings were radiant. They were these most radiant beings. And I would understand why you might think they would have wings.
Sure.
But they would shimmer. They would create these energetic patterns that would come from around them.
Oh, wow.
And they would color, just like emanating colors. And then there was a 13th being that would designate one of the beings. It wasn't in order. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It would designate a being, and then that being would radiate, and that would be the only thing I would see was that one being and this radiated feel of energy, and then this information would come to me. I always described it like a laptop. I didn't know what a laptop was then. There was no such thing as a laptop.
Yeah.
But I would say it was like a laptop that would open up and show me these events. And when I could write, it took me 2 years to learn to walk and feed myself the first time.
Wow.
And when I was able to write, I sat down and I wrote this stuff down. And so my point is this, you're not going to die. Anybody's listening to the show, you're not going to die. So get over it. Number two, who is that spiritual self? How do you connect to that spiritual self? Because it is who you are. And when people go to talk and all that stuff, I said, well, let me tell you something. You're a half a breath from leaving this world on any given breath.
Yep.
And so when that half a breath goes, what else goes? Your voice. So what leaves in that half a breath is the sound of your voice. All your body's there. All the chemicals are there. Everything is there. Everything necessary to think that you're that pile of skin and meat. But your voice is gone, and your breath is, that half a breath is gone. And where and what left and what stayed? That's what people have to stop and look at today. We are killing and destroying children and women, and we are bombing and destroying a 10,000-year-old civilization, 6,000-year-old civilization. And we're talking crazy.
Yeah.
When the bottom line is, you're going to be responsible for every action. And it's going to be based on comparing yourself as what you could have done if you had the right choice, if you had made the right choice. Well, but you're going to be every person.
And, it, you know, that is something that I have always taken away from. And once again, as I said pre-show, Daniel, I have been listening to you on Coast to Coast AM since easily when your first book released. I found Coast to Coast AM in like 95, something like that. So it was right in between your first book. You know, and the one thing that that has always stuck with me about the lifer, I'm getting goosebumps right now just thinking about it, is the idea that it's not like God triumvirate is sitting there, you know, like Father, Son, Holy Spirit, like judging you.
That's all nonsense.
Yeah. It's the fact that you empathetically get to feel from the person's perspective that you hurt, what you did to them.
Like, or that you helped.
Yeah, exactly. That is your hell. Okay. That is your hell, is that you get to experience it as them.
Somebody that you helped. You know, we all are caught up in this guilt term because it's a sub-psychological position placed upon us. Don't buy it. A smile, opening the door, saying hello, and you don't know where that person is. It's the little teeny tiny things that make a difference. So how do you make it better? How do you smile? How do you add some kind of joy to somebody's life? People do it all the time, but they're always caught up in the religious card about sin and going to hell. Yeah. If I didn't go to hell, nobody listening to this broadcast is going to hell. And you can trust me on that. Okay? So when I met these beings of light, I didn't care. Everything was cool with me. I mean, it didn't matter where I was. It didn't matter what was happening to that body. I didn't care.
Now,
no concern.
With the beings of light, Daniel, was it that because you have had subsequent experiences since your first near-death experience?
Oh, I've been dead two or three times. I had open heart surgery, brain surgery. Then I had to have open heart surgery again. I had to be clinically resuscitated three times in 2018.
Wow.
So, you know, I understand death and dying. Wow. Where in the world has all this come from?
Oh, that is down at the bottom of your Twilight Brigade page.
Let me go back to the bottom. That's something new.
Yeah, it's a gallery of all your work with the people that you have worked with over the years. Because once again, like you said, your mission has become working with those that are experiencing death and dying. You've been
caregivers.
Yeah,
I wrote that's what Secrets of the Light is about. That book is for caregivers. I knew what was going to happen, Chris. I have watched. This goes to 2030. All the stuff ends in 2030. Okay, because by then, whatever the new world is going to be established, it will all be that way. Mm. So that means we have 3 or 4 years of what's going to become the new reality that we're living in. You know, that's what's going to become. So it's just people understanding that and looking at who they are energetically and electrically. And I'll make a prediction.
Please.
I'll say that in the next 15 months, the medical establishment is going to teach you and help you understand that you are an electrical being, not that you're a piece of meat. They're going to teach you. They started with the pandemic. They're going to teach you that you are an electrical being. And anybody who doubts what I'm saying, when you get off this broadcast, go to look up CRISPR.
Yep.
Just look up the term CRISPR and read what the patent says they can do to you. You're just a piece of programmable software. Yep. That they can program into your DNA, and they can use 5 and 6G generation to control and manipulate you. And that's what they say they can do. Well, if they say they can do that, move 20 years into the future, and that'll tell you what they're capable of doing.
Yeah. And with these entities, Danyon, would you consider them to be angels, something else? What, in your, I guess, terminology, what would you term them to be? And have you had experiences with them since?
No, I call them beings of light. I have never seen them again. I've never seen them since the first time. I've never seen them again. I mean, and what the mission was, it's 50 years, and what the mission was and what I was to do was to create. It's box 13 in chapter 12. I mean, in chapter 5, box 13, it's the final vision. And so I would not call them angels, because when you go through something like that and you're an asshole, you know, that's me. I was an asshole. I'd hit you in the face. It didn't bother me a bit. It didn't bother me. I'd hit you in the face. Okay, so when you go through something like that, when you start looking at religions, then you look at them from a very critical point of view. And so when I started looking at that, an angel comes from Mercury and Apollo. I think the Greeks had Mercury first, and then came Apollo, and those were messengers, so they had winged feet.
Yep.
There's no winged anything in the Bible. There's no winged beings in the Bible. They walked among us and were handsome and young men. Okay, there's no winged beings. And because Mercury had wings on his feet, because birds had flight, then Apollo had wings on his feet. And so they became messengers, and so they traveled. They traveled by the air and flew, and that's where my angels come from.
Yeah.
Okay. And the only things that had wings was Babylonian, and the Old Testament had to have been written during the 400-year occupation of until Nebuchadnezzar let the Hebrews go. Okay, and from Babylon after 400 years, so the Old Testament had to have been written in that time period. So you had winged beings, and I think what it looks like, if you're an Anunnaki believer, a lot of the animals that they tried to combine, the Pegasuses and the winged animals and the Minotaurs and all those animals, it had to be genetic modification in some way, or these things wouldn't keep appearing in so many different places on so many different carvings.
Yeah, yeah. And
see, I'm fun, Chris. And why did you like to? Let me ask you this: why did you like to hear me on Coast to Coast? Was it because of Art Bell?
Well, I mean, I always loved Art. Don't get me wrong. But it was more the fact of you would go into conversation like this. It wasn't. It was the fact that you are a very upfront and honest person. Even tonight in our conversation, you are very honest about the life that you lived, the way that you were. It's not like this experience came to you because you were an enlightened human being. You know, in that kind of way. It's not like I had meditated for 12 years of my life and finally hit a point of harmonic bliss with the universe and I met the light beings. Like, no, you, and I'll use the term too, because you straight up said, like, I was an asshole.
100%. Listen to me. 100%. This is the point. There's a chance for everybody. Once you just start to realize, no, you're not going to die. And all that crap everybody tells you is never going to come true. Get over it. Second, you're an energetic being. You have 35 billion cells in your body. 35 billion cells. All of those cells are talking to each other. This is a scientific fact.
Yep.
They're all talking to themselves. And how do they know? They're recording the conversation. So if every cell in your body has to maintain between 70 and 90 milliamps of voltage or current in that cell, of light in that cell. If it gets below that, it goes down. If it hits 20, it becomes a cancerous cell. If it moves up to 100, let's say 90, 95, 96, 97, 98, it increases, then the body works more efficient. Okay, so you think about your non-electrical being. How many times a day does your heart beat? Your heart beats between 94,000 and 104,000 times a day. Your body has to produce somewhere close to 45 millivolts of a current in order to make your heart beat. So when you start to tell me you're not an electrical being,
yeah,
all of your cells are talking to each other. And you have to produce 100,000 times a day. You got to produce X amount of voltage so your heart will beat and your cells can sustain 70 to 90 millivolts.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
reality.
Yeah. And it's one of the reasons that they shock you back to life is to provide an electric charge to restart that muscle moving.
I've had that done twice. I've been through that twice.
That is, and that is remarkable, Danyon, to know that, you spent 28 minutes.
Yeah, that's just the first time. Watch this.
Yeah.
This last time in 2008, they had to resuscitate me coming out of the operating room, and the doctor came out and told Catherine and my brother and sister that I wasn't going to make it. Okay, I wasn't going to make it. And this nurse came by and had already worked a 12-hour shift. And he said something told him that this guy had to live. He stayed 2 hours and got my blood pressure up to like 64 over 20. Okay, and I'm on life support. And then he goes home and comes back. And for the next 8 or 9 days, I have this guy. Okay, so after 7 days of coming and going, I go into resuscitation. I had to be resuscitated.
Wow.
On a Sunday morning at 2 a.m. And I went out and they went to banging on my chest and I came out of my body and I stood next to the charge nurse. Here I am. Here's the charge nurse. I'm looking down at them pounding on my body and trying to resuscitate me. And the little cardiologist, she's yelling at me. She's screaming at me. And I knew each person, when one would get tired of beating on my chest, I knew who replaced the next one. And then I knew who replaced that one. And I could know that. And then they brought me back. I came back. I stayed 6 or 7 minutes, and then I flatlined again. All this is like 45 to 50 minutes. And they had to resuscitate me again. I came out again. I never went anywhere. I'm dead on the table. And I'm having to be resuscitated. But I don't call that. That is not a near-death experience to me. That's an out-of-body experience. It might have happened when I was dead, but nonetheless, I think what you like about me, Chris, is I'm always straight.
That's just it. You were as honest as possible. You were as honest as anybody could get about it, Danyon. You pull zero punches. You aren't telling stories in that kind of way. And you know, even that though, and that is an interesting point, because I had a friend that had a near death experience, and when she died, she went somewhere that there was no tunnel. There was there was no council of entities that she met, nothing like that. It was just a void. And
yeah, she was coming back.
For the longest time, people were like, you didn't have a near-death experience.
No, she was coming back.
So yeah.
What happens is those people who are in the light state, you know, there are three levels. When you first lift out of your body, remember there are three levels. You pass through three levels. I know that there are four. I think there are seven levels. I'm aware of four of those levels. I'm aware and conscious of them, but you pass through them. What has to happen is people have to realize if you're coming back, there is no use in putting all that other stuff on you. The divine system is perfect, or as perfect as it gets. There's no use in putting that stuff on you because you're going back. And what happens, what appears to be an accident, is a combination of stuff occurring. So she's coming back. The near-death experience is once you leave that body and you're no longer consciously aware of that body, that's an out-of-body experience. But remember this, Chris. If it had not been for me and Raymond and a couple of other people, they would have no term to use. Okay, at least we have created a term that she can use to get people to stop long enough to pay attention to something that was outside of the physical realm.
Yeah.
It was outside of that realm that she could relate to.
Well, and I just find it interesting, though, that you do not consider your last experience when you died on the table a near-death experience. You consider it an out-of-body experience, even though your heart was stopped. You were medically dead, terminated at the moment.
Nice.
But the fact that you don't consider it a near-death experience, you consider it an out-of-body experience, is very fascinating to me.
Well, I've been in the death and dying business for 50 years.
Yeah.
Okay. And I've been around. I have my 2018 person is Mark. I have him now, and he might have less than a month. Mm. But I've been in this a long, long time, and I see what happens in it. I see all the things that occur. And being honest with people and knowing that that's what they're going to get from me becomes important when you have to make critical decisions about your health. You know, I've always said that the battle for the souls of humankind would be fought in healthcare. And I've lived my life believing and knowing that because I believe that healthcare is the ultimate trap as opposed to cryptocurrency and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I believe that the healthcare is the ultimate trap. And people need to take care of themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think truly one of the, to bring this back to the veterans for a minute, Daniel, I think that that is probably one of the saddest facts amongst things is how little is done for so many of our vets.
It is
horrifying when you dig into it.
I lost 9 Marines last week. So unnecessary. Oh. Bunch of garbage. It's just garbage. It's just garbage. It's craziness.
Well, with that mission in mind, especially the mention of the Twilight Brigade and that mission, I think that is absolutely beautiful. I am a fourth degree Knight of Columbus, and that is, I think, one of the biggest and most beautiful things that we do is go visit vets in old folks' homes, things like that, to make sure that somebody is going and visiting.
Somebody listens. Sure, they have nobody. Come on. Most of everybody they know is already gone. And Vietnam's my age group.
Yep.
You know, there's like 14,000 of 14 million of us, 13.6 million of us. And, you know, after that, the healthcare system, you know, the VA is the largest healthcare system in America.
Yeah.
And so why I chose the VA was for veterans, because I am one. And the fact that structure of that healthcare system will become the groundwork for what I believe will be where the battle for the souls of humankind will be fought.
Well, let's get into this, I guess, last part of mission for you, which is the Brinkley Center, the Brinkley Foundation, and what you guys are, what the mission is, and what people can do to get involved, Daniel.
Well, what they can do is just come and look at the site and see if it feels right to you. You can donate, contribute. I mean, I'm probably a year and a half away from finishing, you know, because of how you have to gather all the stuff and put it together in a certain way. I have to watch where the federal funding is. I have to look at the programs that I can attach it to. But what I'm looking at, if I could take traumatic brain injury, which you cannot drug someone to safety and you cannot drug somebody away from that, and you look at PTSD and traumatic brain injury, and you can affect those energetically, that you can use a certain harmonics. It's all written in Saved by the Light. And you take the steps and this 8-step program, and I can do it with 6 now that the world is digital, and you put people through it and watch what remarkability happens. And for anybody who's listening, to see how long I've been at this, go to YouTube and look up Daniel Brinkley, Joan Rivers, and near-death experience. And look what happened to Joan Rivers when she went through the program. This was in the 90s. This was in the 90s. I've been doing this since 1977. But the guidelines that they gave me, Chris, I was given a strict guideline before between the first pandemic, which has happened, and the second one, which will occur, then this system has to be put in place. I've spent 44 years as a volunteer in the hospice program in the VA. 44 years. So I know the VA backwards and forwards. This is it.
Now,
Joan Rivers, she was talking trash like a New Yorker.
That's what she does.
And I told her, I said, listen, why don't you just come down to Alabama where Raymond and I are developing this program? And she came. So people can watch and see what happens. And the thing I never talked about was she saw her husband who had committed suicide, and she saw she didn't want to talk to him. She went to California. She was in Alabama, but she went to California. She saw her daughter, Melissa, in the shower, and she described in detail the clothes that Melissa was laid out on her bed in detail in California. And she had an encounter with her mother who had passed, and she came to resolution in an issue in dealing with her mother.
Beautiful.
And she was crying when she came out, and I said, Joan, well, Raymond was talking to her, and I said, Joan, why don't you call Melissa? So you can see the recording. She calls Melissa, and they were both fashionistas, and Melissa described identical the conversation of the clothes laying out on the bed. She said, Melissa, what were you doing 25 minutes ago? I was taking a shower. Well, what are you going to wear? And Melissa described in detail exactly what was on the bed. You know, Mom, that dress that belt you bought me, and it sounded like a recording. It's like she had recorded that conversation. It was so perfect. So I think that when a person experiences these kinds of things, if they go through the program, Chris, and they get acclimated to what they're really trying to find resolution to, then I can energetically and frequency wise get them to that state where they can get there. When you say, what's the goal? I always just say, give me 6 traumatic brain injury suicidal veterans and give me 4 days with them. Give me 4 days with them. And because I know the system, I've been to it. I've been over there. I know the system. I know what the issues, what you run into, and I also understand the nature of the harmonics, the nature of how we operate ethereally and electrically.
Well, I was going to say, go ahead on, especially on the ethereally and electronically, because I think that is something that a lot of people really don't get, the concept.
They don't want to get it. If you have 35 billion cells and every one of them has to have 70 to 90 millivolts electricity, then what's keeping you alive? That heartbeat. You got to remember people are institutionalized to believe they are not an ethereal being. And all of science, physics, is driven to keep you outside. Why you pay athletes so much money? Because you get people to seek outside for gratification instead of inward gratification, the nature of true reality. So all of that is a falsehood. People falling for it. You are an electrical being. Ask your doctor.
Yeah.
I laugh at my cardiologist. I said, you know, you guys are either plumbers or electricians.
What?
Because I have to go to an electrophysiologist tomorrow. I said, you know, you're either plumbers, you're cutting on somebody, or right. You're a bunch of electricians. Okay? Because now electrophysiology, what the hell is that?
Well, and, you know, I say it regularly on the show. Like, by all ninth grade science, Danian, we are 90% empty space.
Exactly.
You and I right now, with you on the East Coast, me in Austin, Texas, we are sharing an electron shell. By all known physics.
And we're streaming.
Yeah.
And we're streaming.
Yeah. And our particles.
So don't you know how wonderful I think it is?
Yeah. And our particles and our atoms are commingling with the desk and the microphone. Like, it's all literally part of one system. So
I remember in the first days when I would see the dresser because I was going to put my hand on the dresser. And then the dresser would not be solid. I wasn't back here yet. I was just getting up, just beginning to try to get around. And I couldn't tell where stuff really, I could see it, but I could see its electrical field more than I could see it as being solid. And then I was afraid to put my hand on it because I thought I would fall through it. Because I wasn't completely back into this dimension. I went on with that for 2 years. I mean, I would go to these places. I'd get to my rocking chair, and it'd be 40 minutes to get 12 feet to get to my rocking chair. Then I could roll my toes so I could get them moving and to get in that chair. And then I would go through these places. I would travel to these levels of consciousness. And it was like I was being taught information about energy, about the body, about frequencies and harmonics. And then I was given things that were symbolically representative, like colors and flowers and things that were how colors changed and how light, how the color spectrum, how important it was. And then I would come back. You know, I would come back and I had this rhythm that I would rock with my toes, and then I would look at Gray's anatomy, and I would look at the muscles, and I would know that those muscles were there, and I could move. I would get my hands to finally move because I was completely paralyzed for like 6 days.
Oh, man.
I was partially paralyzed for 7 months, and it took 2 years to learn to walk and feed myself. I mean, I was freaking dead.
And, you know, you described something. There is something that we discuss regularly with people, especially folks like Kathleen Martin, who is the niece of Betty and Barney Hill. She worked with MUFON on the ERT, their experiencer resource team. There are phenomenal shifts that happen with experiencers of all sorts of paranormal events, Danian, and the way I describe it is that it's basically like getting a magnet near a watch. You know, that watch will forever be partially magnetized. It will never tell time right again. You know, it will forever carry the magnetic signature.
It depends on the construction of the watch, though.
Sure, sure. I mean, like a magnetic, a mechanical gear watch in that kind of way. You know, much like the needle of a compass, you know,
I've seen that with crop circles.
Yeah. And we're the same way.
I've been in crop circles. I've been in crop circles. And it was my magnet.
Yeah.
Wasn't somebody else's magnet. I've been in crop circles where that sucker would spin one way and I could turn around and it would spin backwards the other way. And I could walk outside of that crop circle and that magnet would go to north.
Yeah.
And then I probably did it to 10 crop circles. And of that, those 10 crop circles, three of them, I believe, I can't explain. The rest of them, I could explain away.
Well,
okay, but yeah. When that magnet spins around in the middle and you see the crop circle woven together, they are woven like somebody ran through a woven press, okay? Don't tell me.
Well, and, you know, especially things like that. Once again, it's the idea that you, like you said, you came back, and for months afterward, it was almost like you were phasing, like you weren't certain that solid objects were real and there, because
there, but I was not. They were not physical to me.
Yeah,
they were not physical to me. They were energy, and I was not. I knew I was in the room, and I knew that I was in the house.
Yeah,
but I wasn't sure about putting my hand against it, thinking I would fall. Well, I mean, I remember that. I remember that stuff, Chris.
Well, and once again, the fact that your near-death experience literally shifted your frequency in such a way to where you were now seeing that frequency field of objects, things like that, in a way that you weren't before. You know, in a beyond three-dimensional way.
Well, you know, three-dimensional doesn't even exist anymore. We have four. Yeah. You knew you used to have solid, liquid, and gas, and that's what constituted three-dimensional.
Yeah.
Okay, well, now we have another. We have plasma and ether, so we have four parts of matter. And people don't recognize that. Matter is now in four parts. Well, then you could focus on what they call the part I call the ether or plasma. But if you look at that and you study that and you look at it, you will see that you're an electrical being. And once you see that you're an electrical being, look at what you can harmonize with. Look at what humming does. Look what all of those things in synchronicity. Look what chanting does. Look what meditation does. Look what breathing does. You know, I recommended everybody to go to Energy Enhancement Systems, EES Systems. And take a look at what's happening in medicine with the energetic stories of what Sandra Rose Michael is doing. I think it's important. And I've had fun, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Same here, Daniel. And I hope to have you on again and again, because like I'm a frequency musician. I make healing frequency music. One of the albums that I've been working on is actually an album for those that have experienced near death, to kind of help reground them in that kind of way.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. And, you know, these conversations are some of the most important in the world to me, because it's the idea that we can participate in the physics of the universe. We do participate in the physics of the universe, whether you choose to believe it or not, folks. You're doing it. You are constantly throwing pebbles into the water.
You're a stardust child, like it or not.
Yeah, yeah. And you're always throwing pebbles into the pond, you know. And it's we affect so much and have the opportunity to. And we have the opportunity to, stop judging ourselves in that kind of way. We have the opportunity to stop seeing ourselves in a negative spiritual light, in that kind of way, like you're talking about.
You got to do it because it's nonsense. You can't believe stuff that's crazy. You can't believe it's crazy. When you think about it for 5 minutes, I'm guilty of the original sin. Where the hell did that come from? That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. God, okay, so thanks for having me. I hope to be on again where we can laugh some more. And remember, on Coast to Coast, we're going to do an honor of Art's birthday.
Oh, awesome.
So, you know, plug it, because I'm going to tell some funny stories about Art, because, you know, Art and I became literally the very best of friends.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, you can see the best of friends, because Art never believed any of that stuff, and he never believed in empathetic or psychic stuff. And I broke him of the habit. Well, and so we became very good friends off of him understanding that there was some validity to the stuff people were saying. But well, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And always. And you know, we say it at the end of the show. It is the open hearts, the open minds that make the conversation. And that's what I always loved about Art was, believe the guest or not, he didn't care if he believed the guest. He was there to have a conversation about the topic.
Oh, and if you're the devil, Mirror Art, if you're the devil, please call me on the wild card line.
Those were some of my favorite nights. Danyon, thank you so much. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to keep up with everything.
Danyon.com. If you want to have some fun, read Saved by the Light. If you're working, if you're dealing with grief, loss, and bereavement, or you're a caregiver, read Secrets of the Light. And remember, I love and appreciate each and every one of you. And please come and help me help them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Danyon, once again, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for all that you do with the Twilight Brigade. Godspeed with all of that.
And keep me up to date on this music you're creating.
Absolutely. I certainly will. And I will make sure to send links to the show, all that kind of stuff, once it fully posts tonight.
Make sure you send it to Mel.
I will. Mel, thank you so much for everything today. Take care, Danyon. I greatly appreciate the time. Godspeed in all that you do, my friend.
Bless you, my brother.
All right. Take care. While you are online, everybody, checking out everything from Danyon Brinkley over at Danyon.com, as well as checking out everything about the Brinkley Center at Brinkley.Center, everyone, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That's where you can find all of our guest videos, all of our guest YouTube channels embedded on our videos page at CuriousRealm.com/videos. When we come back from this quick commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by Maria Tellier. She is the head of MUFON New Mexico. We will be talking about the Holloman Air Force UFO landing, that case, an affidavit that came to MUFON regarding actual people whose families were involved with the landing. So we will be getting into that with Marie Tellier right after this, folks.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much to our sponsors. And hold on. Restart that, Chris. 3, 2, 1. Well, hello, everybody. Thank you so much for hanging on through that quick break. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you are a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by True Hemp Science today. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science make some amazing products using a spigeric process. They use every part of the hemp plant. And I mean every part. Seeds, stems, fibers, buds, leaves. Every part is used, combusted, and reused until nothing remains but an amazing spagyrically produced product, complete with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by TrueHempScience.com today, folks. They are your source for this amazing stuff. I have traveled the country to dispensaries and searched for great CBD products to use myself. TrueHemp Science is where I settled a good 5-6 years ago when I met Chris at a farmer's market here in Austin, and I have not strayed since. I've tried other stuff, but nothing compares to theirs. Stop on by, check them out today. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get a free edible on your way out the door. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Maria Tellier. She is the director of New Mexico MUFON in Alamogordo, New Mexico. She hosts a monthly program called Coffee Cups and Flying Saucers at the Otero Arts Center, where local reports of unidentified objects, encounter experiences, and the ongoing mystery surrounding the phenomena are discussed with an open mind. As the state director, Maria oversees the training of new field investigators, assigns and reviews cases, and frequently speaks to community groups about the UFO research and investigation cause. Welcome to the show for the first time, Maria Tellier. How are you today?
I'm doing fine, Chris. Thank you so much for showing some love to New Mexico MUFON.
Absolutely. I love New Mexico. This last year was a big New Mexico year for me. I went and provided AV for the Remote Viewing Association conference, a huge community close to my heart there in Cloudcroft. At the same time, got to go see my good friend Lynn Buchanan, who is on the show next week, who you have coming to speak at the Flying Saucer event. So how long have you been involved in the field of UFO UAP study, and what brought you to New Mexico MUFON to begin with, Maria?
Well, actually, UFOs have been in my family. I was born into it. My grandmother was a big believer of UFOs and extraterrestrials coming to our planet. She was always fascinated with it. As children, we sat out back looking for flying saucers and she taught us astrology and she taught us a lot of things while we sat out in the yard at night. So it's something I've always had in my life. I got involved with MUFON when I lived in Connecticut. I had went to a convention up at Exeter, New Hampshire to the Betty and Barney Hill anniversary, met up with MUFON there, decided to join, decided to become a field investigator. So I was up there in Connecticut until 2016. I moved here to New Mexico with Don Burleson, was our state director at that time in New Mexico. Quickly got up to speed in New Mexico. He actually made me the assistant director my second year I was here. And when he retired in 2024, I became the state director.
And what has that experience been like for you? Not only the involvement, but the state directorship, because there is a lot that goes on to leading a MUFON chapter to begin with, but much less a state.
Yeah, there's a lot to do as a state director. Training, I feel training is the most important thing. Making sure people follow the scientific method with their investigations and get to the bottom of it when there's something that's reported. You know, get to that correct final disposition. And I look over all cases and all casework to make sure, you know, I agree that they've looked at every avenue and discussed the evidence, you know, thoroughly and fully with all the witnesses and whatnot. But New Mexico has such a history. Oh, man, my word. I didn't realize it until I moved here, just the history that New Mexico had with flying saucers. I'm still old school. I call them flying saucers. But the history that they have regarding that. You know, in my state, I have Roswell. I have Holloman Air Force Base. I've got White Sands Missile Range, and I've got Dulce Underground Base, all, you know, not to mention Los Alamos, the Trinity site, all that. It's in New Mexico, and it's quite a history. But with it, the people who live here, they kind of are used to it. They don't report it because it's normal.
That's a huge point to bring up, because when, you know, that is something that I have brought up regularly on the show, especially whenever the big drone flaps happened this last year, things like that. It was one of those like, well, wait a minute. We just had a big hearing in Congress about UFOs, UAPs, stuff like that. And literally the words out of their mouths when they were like, why isn't this a bigger conversation? Even Lou Elizondo, that was the last time he was in one of the hearings. He was like, because it would reveal a gaping hole of observation over sensitive areas. And then what do you see next? Appearances of drones above sensitive areas all over the place and mass sightings of drones. And people are like, how come there are so many more drones in the air? And it's like, there aren't any more drones in the air. There's the exact same amount. The only difference is now you're looking for them. You're actively looking for drones and what is a drone now, as opposed to just seeing something in the sky, you know?
Yeah, I get that a lot from people, especially here in Alamogordo, because Holloman Air Force Base is 10 miles from my front door. And White Sands Missile Range is there. And, you know, we also have on the other side of the state, SpaceX is always, you know, sending something up. And I say to people, well, why didn't you report it? Well, they come to my meetings every month and they run up and they tell me their sightings. And I'm like, well, what would you report that to MUFON? Or why didn't you report that to MUFON? And they're like, oh, we see them all the time. We're used to it. It's probably something to do with the base. Well, it may not be.
Yeah.
You know, give me a shot at look, tracking that down and proving that one way or the other.
Well, and that's just it. You know, once again, when things become regular, I remember we need to get back in touch with him, because we were supposed to have Thiago Tietchi back on the show whenever he released his book recently, and things just didn't schedule wise work out. But when we interviewed Thiago, who is the sole MUFON investigator in Brazil, man, like one of the largest places for sightings in the world. And he was, at the time anyway, was the sole MUFON investigator in Brazil. And I was like, you know, do you, especially being out there with the oil fields, all kinds of things, and the natives that live out in the area, I was like, I know it's a long trek in, but whenever you go out to do stuff, do you ever hear reports or get reports from the locals? Have you ever talked to the local indigenous people? And he's like, yes. And they see them all the time. The difference is, for them, it's regular.
It's normal.
Yeah, it's been there for generations.
It's part of their culture. They respect it. And we have to respect it, you know, on that. We're very close to the Muscalero Reservation, and sometimes some people from the reservation do come to my meetings, you know, especially my Lynn Buchanan meeting. They came to that a lot. There's a tremendous amount of sightings in that area, but again, it's part of their culture, and you just have to, they accept it, they respect it, and, you know, we have to follow that with them.
Yeah. And, you know, especially when you start talking about the military bases, they're in close proximity. Like you said, you have numerous bases, including the very famed Dulce base. Which we should do a whole episode on at some point, because that is a fascinating story within the community that I don't know will ever be. I don't know if it'll ever be conclusively proven that the Battle of Dulce Base occurred.
Yeah, I don't know if they'll ever get to the bottom of it. Being down here next to Holloman and White Sands, a lot of times when they talk about the underground bases, they talk that there's an underground railroad or an underground that goes between, especially my bases down here and the Dulce base, and then, of course, over to Los Alamos and to Kirtland. And I wish I could prove it. I had one witness one time come to a MUFON meeting and tell me he worked at White Sands in janitorial. He was in maintenance. I'm sorry, maintenance, not janitorial. But he was telling me, you know, there's an underground railroad under the base there. You know that, don't you? And I'm like, show me where it is. And he's like, show me the entrance. I'm there.
Well, and that's just it. And that, you know, that really becomes and is a huge part of investigation, Maria, is sifting fact from fiction, sorting fact from fiction, yeah. Finding, tracking leads like that down.
Yeah.
When somebody says this is the case. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what you have to do. And I think I've done that myself here on this Holloman Landing case. I've spent a lot of time and a lot of effort, boots on the ground, chasing the evidence down for the Holloman Landing. And I've always been trying to prove that the Holloman Landing was on April 30th, 1964. And we really got MUFON really got a big break in April of 2019 when the Holloman base commander's son came to our MUFON meeting and he stood up and he said that he knew that the Holloman Landing was true because his father was the base commander when it happened.
What?
And yeah, his father was the base commander and his father told him that he saw the aliens meet with the general and Dr. Steinhoff that time. And he pointed to a building on base, which he referred to as the Mars Shack. So I wasn't familiar with the Mars Shack, and I had to hunt that down. And it took me until 2023 to determine exactly that building 930 was the Mars Shack. Now, here's a good picture of it. That's a map of, if you go into the Holloman Air Force Base Visitor Center, that map is up on the wall. And that's where I took a picture of it. And I put a red arrow there pointing to that building. That's building 930. But building 930 is what's referred to as Mars Station. A lot of people call it that. But I wanted to show that to you. In the drawing, the Holloman Landing goes that the craft landed on North Ramp. If you can go back to that other image real quick, Chris, the object at the top, you'll say it says North Southeast Runway. It's at the very top. That's where the aliens landed. And that's referenced in Jacques Vallée's book, Revelations, that they landed on the tarmac on the west end of the base. Then the aliens were taken to what's called King One. And you'll see there's a word on there that says runway access. That area right there is where King One is. And that's the security forces station. If you're uprange at Holloman and you're going to come down into the base proper, you've got to go through that security forces gate, and they refer to it as King One. So in Jacques Vallée's book, he said that the aliens were taken to King One, where they met with the base commander, the chief scientist, and they spoke to the aliens that had come off the craft. And then they were taken to building 930 at the end of Mars Street. And on that map there, that building at the end of Mars Street is building 930, which is referred to as the Mars Shack. So this image you see here is a Google map image, a Google Earth image. I wanted to get the clearest view I could of that building 930, which number one at the top, that's just a Google Earth image. That's from 2016. You see the number two at the bottom? That's what it looks like now because they removed that building in 2023. They excavated it. The only thing left is the big fence that you see around the outside edge of it. But I was able to locate this picture that's on the other side of the image. It says Mars Station. And you can clearly see that that shape with the bump out in the back matches the image in, from the Google Earth map. Now, also, I have an eyewitness. Well, I was trying to find out what a Mars shack is. I didn't know what that was.
Sure.
And, you know, I just didn't know what the terminology was. So I decided to ask someone who I know who worked on base, who was a ham radio operator. And I asked him, I'm not going to say his name, but I asked him, you know what what does Mars stand for? And he said, oh, that's the military auxiliary radio station system.
Yeah.
Now that was part of every military base had a Mars station. And what it was is if there was a natural disaster, hurricane or whatnot, knocked out all the communications, you could go to the Mars station and the old antenna was there and you could make communication. But more importantly, if you were stationed at a base and maybe you lived in Maine and you were stationed in New Mexico and you wanted to call your mom, long distance calls charges were terrible back in the day. So you could go to the Mars station and you could make a long distance call back home and tell your mom you're okay. Or if you were in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, they could call home and let just people know, hey, I'm fine.
Yeah.
Mom,
yeah.
Don't worry about me. It was a godsend, the Mars station, but they're not used anymore with the advent of digital technology and cell phones. Now anybody can make a long distance call and it doesn't cost a dime.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
The Mars stations were pretty much eradicated from the bases because they didn't need them anymore because of the satellite technology and the digital technology. So that's why that Mars shack was removed from that location right there on the base. But the guy I asked, he said to me, he says, it's funny you say that. He said, he worked for the civil engineering department at Holloman. He said, I just had the Mars shack removed. And he said a real funny thing. He said, I had the Mars shack removed and I had a pile of rocks put on top of it that won't be moved for 100 years. And I thought that was a funny statement. And he didn't know I was involved with MUFON or anything like that. I was honestly just asking him because I was trying to educate myself as to what a Mars station was. Well, once he told me that, I realized that that was building 930 when he told me that, because I could look on the map that's there in the visitor center and I knew exactly where building 930 was. I drove out there myself. I couldn't believe it that I finally found the Mars shack. And when I got out there, he was right. That building was gone. There was nothing but a pile of rocks there. The gates were thrown open. I drove my car in there. I got out. I wanted you to look at this picture one more time and look at the side view. When they said that the aliens were taken to building 930 and they spoke with the base commander, there was a lot of speculation that there was an underground base or there was a room underneath the Mars shack. And that's where they were taken to, because in Vallée's book, he actually says they stayed there for 2 or 3 years translating for the Americans.
Mm.
But I looked at that picture and I could tell by looking at that picture, there's no underground shaft. There's no underground room. You can see it's just up on blocks. And actually myself, I ran around that yard after I got in there. I was so excited. And I looked for signs of excavation or filling in a hole or a dip, anything that would have shown that there possibly had been something under that building, and there wasn't. And the picture, I found the picture recently within the last year, the that old Polaroid with no metadata for me to look at, but I'm confident that that's from probably the 70s or 80s, an old 35 millimeter film, you know, developed. Holloman had the development capabilities. That's why everything was pictures that were taken at White Sands Missile Range, a film that was taken at White Sands Missile Range. The crew from Holloman shot those. because they had access to the development equipment and they had the dark room. They were the ones that did that kind of stuff. And they did that at the Holloman Air Force Base. So that's how all the films and whatnot ended up down there. But, you know, the story itself of the Holloman landing was that three objects were above Holloman Air Force Base. One landed on the tarmac. The aliens came out. One was carrying a staff of some sort. The base commander, the chief scientist, and someone from security forces, I believe, went up to them, and they were able to communicate with the base commander through the staff. The staff was some type of translation device. They were taken to King One. The aliens went to Building 930, and their craft, the UFO, was taken to Building 830, where it was unloaded. Now, that's referenced in Jacques Vallée's books. That was referenced in Timothy Good's books. Also, when you go back and you go back to the very beginning and you go back to April 30th, 1964, APRO, the Aerial Phenomenon Research Organization, they first, there was a landing at Holloman in the May 1964 APRO bulletin. Then they also in that bulletin that just that month was the Socorro landing. So the May bulletin was full more of the Socorro information. When the July bulletin came out, that was full of the Holloman landing and all their information and all their evidence that they had collected. And they spoke to FPS-16 radar operators who told them that they saw the crafts on radar that day and the time, 5:45 a.m. That also correlates with Jacques Vallée's book. Well, Jacques Vallée was a DOD contractor. He worked for Project Blue Book with Dr. Hynek. He had access to all that information. So the fact that his book matches the data is great. And that was the only evidence we had until we got the MUFON affidavit in 2019. We were sitting in the MUFON meeting. Don gave a wonderful presentation regarding some evidence he had found regarding the Holloman landing. He asked if anyone had anything to add. Guy stood up, said he was the son of the base commander. But the base commander's name was Henry Godman, and his son Lou was there that day. He told us that he had driven his father on base. His father was ill. He was dying of cancer. And he loved the base. His father loved the base. He wanted to get cheered up. So Lou put him in the car. They went over to base. When they were driving around base, his father asked him to stop. He pointed to the building. He said that is where the general and Dr. Steinhoff met with the aliens that time, right there in the Mars shack. And Lou was kind of amazed by it because his father really didn't talk about his stuff when he was on base. He kept it, you know, pretty much to himself. But that's what he told him that day. And we were shocked at the meeting. You know, Don took him and interviewed him, and he actually had the physical. He had an affidavit in his hand, a notarized document with that statement on it. The other statement that Lou had is that he remembered as a child when they lived on base, the red phone ringing, the red phone he wasn't supposed to touch. It rang one night, woke the whole house up. His father ran out. And the next day when his father came back, Lou had found out from his father, whether his father was talking to his mother or what, told him that he had to leave in a hurry because security forces had saw a UFO land on base and he had to go out and investigate it. Now, he has that memory as a child, and he put it together when his father in 1995 told him about communicating with the aliens that had landed on base. Kind of when he put those two things that had happened in his life together and thought that they were related.
Well, and now, once again, this meeting that he stood up in, that was the first time that he'd ever shared this story. He'd never come forward before. His father never had, aside from with him. And I don't know if you'd necessarily call that a deathbed confession if you're driving around a military base. However.
Yeah. Well, he did die shortly after that.
Yeah.
Lou said that his father loved the Air Force. He loved Holloman. After he retired, he stayed there. He stayed here with his family. You know, he really was a locally well-known individual. And I thought this was really, I said, okay, well, I've got to vet this information on this thing. I have to find out, okay, was Henry Godman really the base commander? And when was he the base commander? Does the dates match up? Because Lou wasn't certain of the date that his father didn't tell him the date that it had happened. But when I went to look it up, I couldn't find any evidence of Henry Godman being the colonel at Holloman Air Force Base. I went to Holloman Air Force Base's website, their past commanders. He wasn't listed. I went to the 49th Wing Building. They have a giant mural on the wall at the 49th Wing Building, and it has every aircraft that ever flew on Holloman. It has a timeline with every commander, a line with every commander on it, not Henry Godman. So, believe it or not, I found reference that he was at Holloman. I found it on Wikipedia, which I don't believe anything I find on Wikipedia. So I really, really had to drill into that a whole lot more because I couldn't believe it. But I went to the Holloman, I'm sorry, I went to the Alamogordo Library, and they had microfiche for all the Alamogordo daily local newses. And I started ripping through those things to April of 1964. No mention of the Holloman landing, of course.
Interesting.
But I went about a year into it, and it had the retirement of Colonel Henry Godman, the retirement party. They had a huge retirement party for Henry Godman. This town loved the man. The Civic Center had his retirement party in July of 1965. I was able, once I found that little nugget, I was able to really drill in and find that he was stationed at Holloman 1963 to 1965. He retired after 29 years in the Air Force at Holloman. He retired. He kept his family here. At his retirement party, the mayor, the senator, the governor, the people from the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was a really big deal in the Air Force. And I was like, why isn't he anywhere at Holloman? Why isn't he listed on the board? Why isn't he on the website? I started snooping around at all Air Force bases. They name everything after somebody. Every street's named after somebody that was there. Every building, conference rooms are even named after people, but not Henry Godman. Now, I found that there's a memorial garden next to the Officers Club named after Dr. Steinhoff, the chief scientist.
Huh.
I thought, well, we got Dr. Steinhoff, but we don't have Colonel Godman. That's really, really strange. But I dug around a little more, and I was able to find, I have a copy of it. I don't think I gave you a copy of this. He had written a book called The Supreme Commander. It's terrible.
That's okay. You're good right there.
Right there. Supreme Commander. He wrote a book, and it has a chapter all about his time at Holloman and how he loved the base and how he loved Alamogordo. So I was very, very happy once I found that, because I certified that Colonel Henry Godman served at Holloman during April 30th, 1964, which is the reported date of the Holloman landing. Recently, that's been spoken a lot about because of the movie The Age of Disclosure. When Dr. Davis spoke with, he spoke with President Bush, and President George Bush said he was briefed on the Holloman landing in error, but he was told that it happened in April of 1964, that it was real and that the security was obscene. So again, that backs up the Holloman affidavit when we have President Bush also talking about it in the movie The Age of Disclosure.
Yeah. Yeah. And they, you know, once again, and I have held for a long time and said for the longest time, if there is any president, people ask, like, why wouldn't a president be read in? Because they are considered part-time employees. They are in it for the long haul. They're there for 4 years. Yeah. So what, you're going to disclose everything to them? That's like a long haul, 80-year, 100-year term project?
Yes. Likely not. President Bush, yeah, he wasn't read in. He wasn't briefed on Holloman when he was president. He was briefed on Holloman when he was the CIA director under President Ford. So
yeah.
They had no intention to tell him when he was president.
Oh, no.
I believe it was an error. I believe they told him. They assumed he knew about the Holloman landing when he was CIA director.
No, that's just it. And that's what I always say, is if there is a president who knew anything aside from maybe Eisenhower.
Yeah,
because he was a general, and he may have known something before he became president. Just because his strategic role. However, if there was a president that ever knew, aside from him, it would have been George Bush, because he headed up the CIA after Dulles.
Yeah, exactly. So, I knew the George Bush thing because they had come out in the Wilson Davis memo back in 2002. But, Dr. Davis wouldn't admit, that anything to do with it until recently, until that movie, The Age of Disclosure. And now he's talking about it openly. And I think that's why this interest in the Holloman landing has kind of cropped up again. I was a little surprised in 2019 when MUFON got that affidavit that there wasn't a lot more interest in it, because it names the commander on the base that spoke to the aliens. And it plainly names that in our affidavit that it was Colonel Henry Godman. It also verifies the information that was published by Dr. Vallee and again by Timothy Good in their books and people after that have also spoken about it. It backs up the APRO data. APRO had it in the APRO bulletin in July of 1964 that there were objects in Holloman's radar, and that they had a note in there that we can't give names and we can't be more specific, because we people have their jobs to worry about. A lot of their contacts were on base. The Lorenzens had lived in Alamogordo in 1954 to 1960, and they worked at Holloman. So a lot of their contacts were people working and presently at that time working on base. So they kind of had to be cautious about what they said. But I got to track every lead down. So I went to the National UFO Research Center in Rio Rancho that has the APRO documents.
Awesome.
It has all the casework. It has their 17 filing cabinets and everything. I said, okay, I'm going to go to Rio Rancho and I'm going to find the Holloman notes. I'm going to verify that the object was on the radar and that they had witnesses that, one witness was an airman who was guarding a UFO that was locked in a hangar on Holloman. I wanted to find those notes. I wanted to find that original data. And Dave Marler has that at the National UFO Research Center.
Yep.
But when I got there and I went to 1964, that file was gone. That file was not there in any way, shape, or form.
Oh, wow.
So Dan, Dave helped me. We went searching for it. We're like, this is crazy. It's the first time we haven't found a file. We went into a miscellaneous filing cabinet that they had that was by title. It was called, military, whatnot. Again, I went through myself personally. I went through every single folder in that entire four drawer filing cabinet looking for that Holloman folder, and it just was not there. So, Dave said that when he received the entire APRO collection, he had been told that it was there in its entirety and that they never let anyone look at it. They had come into possession of it after Miss Carl Lorenzen passed. She passed it on to this group in Scottsdale, Arizona, and they locked it up and they didn't let anyone at it. they didn't even let their son, the Lorenzen's son, Larry Lorenzen, wanted to go through the files because there were some personal documents in that personal pictures. His parents died. His sister died. He wanted to find pictures of them. They wouldn't even let him in there. So, you know, Dave Marler and I were talking about it, and he goes, well, you know, now I kind of remember, they did tell me the only person they let look at those files was Dr. Jacques Vallée. So I was like, wow, really? Really? But, you know, like I said, I'm going to go back up to the research center and dig a little more. But, you know, the Holloman folder is gone. I had saw some information from their old librarian. His name was, I can't remember his last name. His last name was Benz. He was the librarian. And he says, well, you know, the Lorenzens kept the real sensitive stuff locked up back at their house. They didn't keep it in the library with everything else. So there's a possibility that it could be in their personal stuff and just didn't come with the collection. But I'm going to go up there and be digging around some more because I'd really like to have the firsthand interviews with the radar operators who saw the objects. I'd like that more technical data to be able to back up the affidavit a little more, at least from APRO's side, because that gives us the date, April 30th. And that's the important thing, that we nail that date down, the date and time. April 1964, it's great to be able to verify that, but I'd like to be able to nail it to a date and time.
Well, with that date and time in hand, and especially with the fact of, you know, you've got an airport up the road, you've got White Sands for whatever they're going to release through FOIA. But is there any way that you could FOIA request radar reflection data from that day to see if there was any anomaly reported or if there was any anomaly at least within the system?
I believe that Greenwald has over at the Black Vault, you know, he's got nothing back as far as I could find looking, because I've looked through his FOIAs too.
Sure.
To see if I could find it, if I could find anything on it. Because it happened so close. Just 7 days prior was the Socorro landing with Lonnie Zamora. That was just 7 days prior. And a lot of that data has been released, you know. But again, the Holloman landing happened on an Air Force base. That's why the only place you would really read about it was in that APRO bulletin. It wasn't in newspapers. It was not like the Socorro landing was, but not the Holloman landing. That wasn't in local newspapers. It got no airtime whatsoever.
Interesting. And, you know, once again, I think that they had definitely learned their lesson as far as coverage, news media coverage, and what comes out of a front office, what comes out of a PO, a public information officer, you know, the people who are typically responding to media requests, the people who are typically contacting the media, things like that. Typically the people that you would contact to be like, hey, who is so-and-so on base? That kind of stuff. So I think... Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, another part of the affidavit was in two parts. It was a conversation that was between Lou Godman and, I'm going to call this person, a radio show host. So Lou Godman and this local radio show host had this conversation, and that's where this speaking about his father, speaking to the aliens on base, him hearing the red phone ring. Well, the other gentleman had something that he had to add to the affidavit, and that was that he had been contacted by the chief scientist's son. The chief scientist's son had received a phone call from a psychiatrist in California. He was looking for Dr. Steinhall because he had to ask him a question. The psychiatrist had a patient who was still having mental trauma regarding an incident. Now, his patient had been stationed at Holloman in the early 60s, where he witnessed Colonel Godman walk up to a UFO and speak with aliens. And that was the trauma that this patient was having. The psychiatrist was calling, and the patient also said he spoke with the aliens, that there were helicopters in the air photographing everything. There were photographers on the ground photographing it. And the base scientist was there also. So that's why they were calling Dr. Steinhoff to try to, the psychiatrist wanted to confirm, could this have possibly happened? Or is this just something in my patient's head? Is this another issue? And of course, Dr. Steinhoff had passed. Dr. Steinhoff had passed by that time. And, you know, his son had no, he said, my father never discussed work at home. So Dr. Steinhoff's son had actually went to this radio show host because the radio show host had a UFO radio show in Alamogordo. So he went to him and said, all three of them knew each other, Lou Godman, the host, and the scientist's son. They all knew each other from school. They're all same age. So Dr. Steinhoff's son went to the radio show host and said, hey, did Lou Godman ever say anything about his dad meeting, you know, meeting aliens on base from a UFO? I got a call from the psychiatrist who has a patient who saw your dad, you know, who saw Lou's dad talking to an alien, and he said my father was there. And the radio show host said no, he had no knowledge of that. But that's the reason how this all got into an affidavit, because that was the first question. I spoke with both witnesses. Yeah. I spoke with Lou Godman and I spoke with the radio show host, and I said, why did you put your conversation in an affidavit? What would draw you to do that? And the radio show host said, well, I've just found in my life that it's best when someone tells you something really spectacular and that could affect history, you really should write it down and you should get it notarized.
Yeah.
At that time, I didn't know he had been a radio show host. He was just some guy, you know? But as I researched into it more, I found out that he had a radio program in the 90s about UFOs that he broadcast here out of Alamogordo.
Okay.
So everyone knew him as, like, they know me as the local UFO person now. Now, they knew him back then as being it. So that would be the logical person you would ask. Hey, you know anything about a flying saucer landing on Holloman and your dad talking to him?
Yeah. 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 And you know, it's interesting. My wife's grandfather was chief of homicide in Boston for a little while. His advice, they always laugh. The only advice that they ever got from their grandfather was never write anything down. Was never write anything down. It will come back to haunt you.
It'll come back to get you.
But it's interesting that that's the exact opposite advice from the radio host is a yes. Whenever you hear something that extraordinary, you should document it in a different way. You should treat that data in a different way. I have two unreleased episodes ever. One of them was thrown away live. At a conference where somebody bullied up on another person that I had interviewed. And I was like, I do not kinder to that either behind a booth or on my airwaves. And I am not going to give that person any more energy or airwaves. So I threw theirs out. But another one is a bombshell interview that I have about human trafficking that I am still trying to vet. The person who is the trafficking victim. But if I released that, man, boy, howdy. And that's just it. It's one of those, like, even watching the S4 documentary that just came out with people like George Knapp, you know, as an investigator myself, as even doing the show that I do, even you yourself as head of New Mexico MUFON, like you said, there are people who come to you with things. You know, there are people who come to me with things. I just had a researcher reach out to me all of 3 weeks ago and was like, hey, I have these presentations. I'm getting ready to pitch some stuff. I haven't shown anybody this data. Would you be willing to look at my presentations and see if they make sense? Like you at least know what some of this data is and what its connections might be. So maybe you can give me some feedback. But even the fact that somebody sees me in that light, where a researcher of renowned and ilk would send me their presentation before they go live with it to get my opinion on such things. Those things happen. Those things come to you. You know, that's how deathbed confessions happen. That's how people like this good gentleman whose dad ran Holloman Air Force Base finally decides to come through with his family story, you know?
Yeah, and I had to vet the data. I didn't want to just go on someone, you know. We published it in the MUFON Journal. We have permission from Lou Godman to publish it. We have permission to say his name and to say his story. But I still wanted to vet the data. You know, I'm always looking for everything. Just like I said, I want to find that radar data because it's just one more piece of the puzzle that you want to find. The fact that so many people have come forward after I've talked to them about it and told me, you know, the good example is that the UFO show host, I had my Coffee Cups and Flying Saucers meeting. I had a meeting about APRO, the Alamogordo years it was called, and he read about it in the newspaper and he sent me an email to tell me that him and his mom and Carl Lorenzen were great friends when they were in Alamogordo. And, you know, that's kind of how I found out who he was. And I was able to interview him about it because he had actually saw something about my Coffee Cups and Flying Saucers meeting. I have a monthly meeting and he read that about APRO in there and gave me a call and we discussed it at length. And this Holloman affidavit, he emailed to me. He says, I got something you might want to see. And he emailed it to me. And I looked at it and I said, oh, my God, he's the other name on the affidavit that, you know, we've been blacking out for years. And it was really, it's a small town, but it was really nice that all that kind of wrapped up and came together. And again, just through my monthly meeting, I was able to make that contact because, like I said, people come up to me at every meeting telling me their stories and, you know, I've got to vet what they say. I can't just take it on their word.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I say all the time on the show, because I am an experiencer, because I have had my thing. I mean, I joined the seminary for the Catholic Church off a religious experience. All right. So it's one of those, like, I'm a believer's believer, but because of that, my realm of proof, my realm of data has to be higher. One of the battle cries of this show is evidence is what frees you in court. Never let it be less than that. Aside from that, it's data. But until the day you can hand it to your lawyer and say, like, this will keep me out of prison for life, that's evidence. Yeah. All right. And nothing called evidence should ever meet a standard less than that. Aside from that, it's data coming into a system.
My old state director in Connecticut told me the evidence will lead you to the answer.
Yeah.
The evidence will lead you to the answer. Until you have the evidence, you just have a good story.
That's it. And, you know, I will believe any experiencer until proven otherwise.
Yeah.
And I will search for the data. I will look for the data. And I've said, you can literally Google it, folks. Feel free to go through and listen to thousands of hours of Curious Realm. I encourage you. But I've said regularly about my religious experience, Maria, that should it be proved later in life that I have some sort of issue or palsy or, you know, epilepsy that caused that religious experience. Okay. That doesn't change the experience.
Right.
It doesn't change that moment. It doesn't change how that moment filtered my life. It doesn't change how my life has been viewed since that moment. Doesn't change any of the actual experience of that moment. It changes the catalyst of that moment.
Just gives it a
Nothing
name.
More.
Just gives it a different name. Yeah.
And that's kind of what I tell people about the paranormal. You know, just because someone like yourself, someone like myself explains what is in your red circle, in your picture, does not remove your moment of experience. It doesn't remove the moment that you took that picture or the moment that you saw that picture and saw something and it made you question and it made you go down the rabbit hole and it made you find more. That is literally science. Like science begins with experience.
Yeah,
it begins with an observation. It begins with seeing or experiencing something. And from there, you question it and you research more data and then you experiment. And then once you think you have a hypothesis, you pass all that data on to someone else and they wash, rinse, repeat it and see if they come to the same hypothesis or if your hypothesis is destroyed. But it's experience that starts it.
You always ask someone, you know, what do you think? You know, I go to people, you know, it's like someone like you. I asked you about a photograph I sent you. Dave Marler and I spoke at length about the Holloman Landing. My old state director, CJ, my current regional director, we talk about that stuff, but you've got to follow the evidence and you've got to vet it. You've got to vet it. You can't just assume. I mean, I could assume the information I read in Jacques Vallée's book is perfect because just on his reputation, but the fact that my affidavit backs that up just makes the words in his book stronger, and it also makes the words on my affidavit prove that someone else also had come to the same conclusion.
Exactly. It at least bolsters the claim. Does it prove the claim ironclad? No, but it bolsters the claim and it gives it some
stronger
provenance.
Yeah, and it makes it stronger. Yeah, and again, like you said, it puts you down another rabbit hole.
Yeah. But the thing is that you never stop looking. You can't stop looking. The minute that you stop looking, science is now static and it's dogma. It's not science anymore. And that's just it. We have these questions. We have these things that pop up. We have these things like Holloman that have happened that have become mythos. Maria, and the question comes to bear, what happens when Holloman is proven or disproven? You know, like right now, I love my cryptozoology community. Don't get me wrong. Probably the Psi community is my favorite community I belong to, honestly. However, right now there is a huge kerfuffle within the cryptozoology community about a movie called Discovering Bigfoot that just came out at South by Southwest and has called into question that the Patterson-Gimlin film of fame is faked and that there is footage of the practice run of the Patterson-Gimlin film that is in this documentary. The thing is, that doesn't mean Sasquatch isn't real.
Right.
Because you've disproven that piece of footage doesn't mean the phenomena is not a thing.
Correct.
So even if Holloman is proven or disproven, even if it's disproven to be utterly a fabrication, utterly, it does not remove the phenomena. It doesn't. It means that we as people tend to go down a storied rabbit hole. We tend to love a good story. We tend to love some intrigue, and when these criteria are met, sometimes even in the most meager of ways, we are willing to fully follow the rabbit down the hole, just like Alice, you know. But there is a whole panoply of things, even to the fact that you worked at Holloman.
Yeah.
You can confirm the fact that this building was there and is gone. Why?
Yeah.
How can you confirm that fact for us, Maria?
Yeah, I drove right over to it. I drove right over. I did donuts. But I think the thing which was that I was able to identify, because the colonel only ever referred to it as the Mars Shack.
Mm.
Was being able to tie that Mars Shack to Building 930. Now, we had years of everyone saying they went to Building 930, they were on Building 930, but he said he spoke to the aliens at the Mars Shack. Being able to remember, I think, just one of the table on this. Biden thing, telling people to work for him. And I'm still intrigued by his comment that he had a pile of rocks for 100 years. That's such an odd statement, and I'm digging into that quite a bit, trying to figure out why. Why did they? Why did? And it does have a lot of rocks on it.
Sure does.
There's a pile of rocks to put on that lot, but you can, you know, I had a lot of other Google Earth images throughout the years because you can adjust the date on Google Earth and go back to it. You know, but I watched that building through the years. And that one up at the top from 2016 is definitely the clearest one. Quite a few years it was blurred out. Quite a few years it was that image on that lot was just blurred out. The other images were clear at the building. There's five buildings in front of it. Those were always clear, crisp and clear, but that one was always a fuzzy mess until...
I could understand that if it is a point of communication on the base, even if it's using the reference you were using earlier. I'm a huge MASH watcher.
Yeah.
And that's always something that I love as not just a MASH watcher, but a radio user, is the fact that like they were pinging across the globe to make a localized phone call through ham radios, things like that. Yeah. Like it would go through a ham operator somewhere before it hit a PBX switchboard. But if that is what that shack was used for, noted by the radio antenna right there in the Mars picture.
Right in the picture.
And if that is the case and you can see the antenna array, stuff like that, then, yeah, even if it was used to make phone calls home, if it was used as a last point of communication, where it's like, worst case scenario, we're going to send out a telex via telemetry, you know, and send out a Morse code signal, that is still a point of strategic communication on the base, and you would not want that to be seen or known in that kind of way.
And also the Mars shack where it was located, when you look at the base on a whole, that was at the far west edge of the base. So is that north ramp, which is right above it. That is on the outskirts of Holloman. That if you see that long straight line going down the side, that's the boundary between White Sands Monument and Holloman. I mean, this is the very far outskirts of the base. And back in the 60s, there was no infrastructure out there. There's a lot of infrastructure out there now. There's the water treatment plant. There's more hangars. There's maintenance buildings and whatnot. But back then, there wasn't. Nothing was out there. Bear Base is out there now. There's a large base facility out there called Bear Base that was not. When you look at that picture that's there now, all that infrastructure that's in front of that five lines of buildings, none of that was there between there and 49er Road. Back in 1964, none of that stuff was there. It was just the Mars shack was out there with that radio antenna. And, you know, like you said, for communication purposes, and also that's the gateway between White Sands Missile Range and Holloman. That was the road you would come down. You would come down that Kelly Road if you were up we call it Wismer. If you're up in Wismer and you're going to Holloman, you would come down that Kelly Road that's right there, and you would have to go through King One. You would have to go through the security station and show your identification that you could go through there and then make your way onto Holloman Base. So it was a strategic location, but it was a very secluded location. So if you were going to take a UFO and an alien somewhere, that would be the spot on base that you'd want to hide them.
And you know, you have to ask at some point, you know, why Holloman? Why choose Holloman as a location to land? Why choose that as a point of communication? Why stay there for 2 years translating and helping with technologies?
Yeah, I haven't found any evidence to back that up. Not that I'm not looking.
Oh, sure.
I am. But the location of Holloman, it's it borders White Sands Missile Range. White Sands Missile Range is where the Trinity,
where the atom was split.
Where the atomic bomb was exploded right there. And actually, in part of the Lorenzen's discussion that happened that day, that they put, it happened at Stallion Gate, is where the radar was that saw these objects on. You know, they saw one land at Stallion Gate. One landed in White Sands Missile Range. Another one landed at Holloman. Their information pretty much backs up the one up at White Sands Missile Range, but that was less than 25 miles from where the atomic bomb was detonated. So, I mean, it's a hot area. It's always been a hot area. And for researchers and for everyone, that is the place to be. If you're looking for the smoking gun, that would be where it's hiding.
Well, there are, I think, numerous smoking guns coming out right now. We'll see what happens on July 8th as far as disclosure drop. I find it funny that there are more people calling into question why NASA launched on April Fool's Day, when it's like, you know, man, when a launch window happens, like, you take a launch window, you take a launch window. You can't, like, it doesn't matter if it's Friday the 13th. If it's like the day JFK got shot, doesn't matter what the superstition or foolishness behind the day is, you do it because that's your narrow window of success. But nobody is calling into question that this magnanimous speech about UFO disclosure is supposed to happen on the exact day that they announced the disc being found at Roswell.
Well, we'll see what happens on July 8th.
It's July 8th is when, July 8th is when the Roswell UFO announcements happened originally. So it's one of those, like, nobody's asking questions about that. Like, you, that's a big red flag to me. That's when the speech is scheduled.
But that would be to get the most effect. You know, it would be the most dramatic. It would be the most, grandeur. That would be the date you would do it on. If you were writing a movie or a screenplay, that would be the date. Kind of like the movie Independence Day.
Sure.
You know, the date on July 4th, you know, that big.
I don't think most. Here's the thing, though. I don't even see any kerfuffle in the community or, once again, anybody asking, like, that seems very false flag.
That seems
more than conspiratorial. Maria,
I'm going to be in Roswell this year. MUFON's going to have a table. We'll get to meet you in person. I'll be at the UFO Museum. I'll be out in the lobby. MUFON will be out there.
Awesome.
Yeah, I've been trying to do it the last couple of years, and I finally got a table there. So
good for you.
I'm really looking forward to it, and we'll see if everyone's talking about that big speech that's coming when I'm there at Roswell, standing next to the newspaper clipping that started the whole thing rolling.
Exactly. Maria, thank you so much for your time. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to get involved, where they can go to become a field investigator, where they can go to join MUFON, and where they can go to join us, because I will actually be speaking at the MUFON Symposium this year in Covington, Kentucky. You can go. I'll do my part right now as a speaker. MUFON Symposium 2026, folks. UFO revelations and the impact on society and science is the theme. It is happening my birthday weekend in Covington, Kentucky. Stop on by, check it out. MUFONsymposium.com is the website where you can purchase tickets. The amazing Peter Robbins is going to be there. Stacy Wright is going to be there. Alex Dietrich, all kinds of great folks. I will be speaking as well. There are going to be some awesome panels, as well as field investigator training. And that's where I'll let you take it over, Maria.
Yeah, well, to become a MUFON field investigator, you just have to go to www.mufon.com, and there's a little click on there that says that you can join. The first thing you have to do is you have to join MUFON. You become a member. once you are a member, you can take that extra step to be, if you feel you need, just like I did after I was a MUFON member for about 6 months, I decided, wow, I need just a little bit more. And becoming a field investigator is where you go. You go to it. You go to it from our website, and you can get the MUFON investigator manual. You study that manual and you take a test and you become an investigator in your state. Now, I train all the investigators in my state, in New Mexico. They get 5 cases where I work with them hand in hand. And then they get out on their own and they start they start investigating cases and doing the field investigator work themselves after their training. We also have MUFON University, which is a training platform that MUFON uses to train our field investigators. And that is found online. But the first step is to become a MUFON member. And when I'm at Roswell, I have some brochures and whatnot I'm going to be handing out. But also you can go to a local chapter meeting. Like I have my coffee cups and flying saucers at the Otero Arts Building in Alamogordo. I have it on the third Saturday of every month at 11 a.m. And that's where we get together. This month's topic is the Holloman Landing, of course. I'll be talking more about the affidavit, and we'll be, you know, every April I do the Holloman Landing. So that's this month's topic on the 18th. Also, I talk to people about local sightings. We see a lot of things in Alamogordo that I can't get people to report, but we talk about it at the meetings, and someone will see something and the person sitting next to them saw the same thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a wonderful place to get together and just talk about like-minded people and like-minded topics.
And, you know, meetings like that are hugely important. Getting together with people of like mind is hugely important. And reporting what you see is hugely important, mainly because, once again, like you said, more than one person regularly says, oh, I saw that too. Things help triangulate stuff. They help you figure out if they were the same sighting, different sightings, all kinds of stuff. So all kinds of data is gathered from your sighting report, folks. And remember, just because something is in the red circle, just because your sighting has been explained, doesn't remove your experience. What it means is that you have now contributed to the scientific process of knowing the known quantitative, which only further narrows what the phenomena is. The more we know about the known quantitative, the more we learn about the phenomena itself. So you are contributing, even if what you have seen and what you report is fully explained and explainable. So thank you again, Maria. I greatly appreciate your time. I appreciate your wealth of knowledge on this topic. I look forward to having you back again to talk about other New Mexico cases, all kinds of things.
All right. Thank you again, Chris. Really, we don't get a whole lot of love out here in New Mexico. It was really great to be able to speak with you today.
Well, I look forward to having you on again and again to talk about such things. And I look forward to seeing you out at Roswell UFO Fest. I will be there with my family. So, and of course, getting interviews.
Great.
So,
Wow, that's wonderful.
Absolutely. Hold the line real quick. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online, everybody, checking out MUFON at MUFON.com, joining, becoming a member, all of that good stuff. Make sure to stop on by Curious Realm, curiousrealm.com/store is where you can find our book and movie store. That's where you can find all the books, films, classes, other things from our guests, as well as your link to the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are a researcher into the world of UFOs, UAPs, cryptozoology, paranormal, and you are out doing field research or taking, witness statements, things like that, the Field Observation and Encounter Log is literally your back pocket field log to write all of this data down in the field as it happens so that your data is ready to shake hands with science come the day that it needs to do so. Thank you so much, everybody, for your time tonight. Thank you for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit GroundZeroPlus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious, and remember, the other side is always watching.